Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Welcome to our second talk in the audio course, Mindfulness Where Dharma Meets Practice. Today I'll finish talking about living in mindfulness. Last week I described Buddhist practice as the skill of life. We acquire the skill under the guidance of the Dharma. Mindfulness or recollection is needed to keep the Dharma constantly in mind. The scope of Buddhist practice. We've talked about skill, but what is this Dharma we should be continually recollecting? The Dharma guides us as to what is skillful and unskillful. Its central teaching is the Four Noble Truths, which start, like last week's talk, with suffering. The Four Noble Truths are the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the way to the cessation of suffering. Truths suggest propositions we're invited to accept, but the Buddha turns these immediately into practice tasks. For the truth of suffering, our task is to understand our suffering. Understanding or insight is, in fact, the main engine of skill acquisition for Buddhists. For the truth of the cause of suffering, which we're told is craving, our task is to abolish its cause. Recognizing causal relations is how we disentangle the tangle of samsara. We already loosen up a particularly difficult snarl by first teasing apart another knot that is easier. Part of understanding suffering is to understand the conditions under which it arises. For the truth of the cessation of suffering, our task is to realize that cessation. This is one way of stating the ultimate point of Buddhist practice. For the truth of the way to the cessation of suffering, which we are told is the Noble Eightfold Path, our task is to develop, that is, to practice and master that path. The framework of the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path illustrates how Dharma is a scaffold for practice. Each teaching is a pointer to a specific aspect of practice. The eight path practices are as follows. Right understanding is a correct understanding of the Dharma acquired through reading or listening, study, reflection, and deep examination. Right understanding is how we understand the cookbook of practice as we internalize it level by level. Since this audio course is intended to get you started in right understanding, you are, with a bit of diligence, already practicing right understanding. Although based in Dharma, right understanding is not the Dharma itself, but our deepening, living understanding of the Dharma. Properly speaking, recollection or mindfulness bears right understanding in mind, not just Dharma. But for simplicity, I'll continue to talk about mindfulness of Dharma. There is a skill to acquiring right understanding, just as there is a skill to the study, research, and reflection which we would need, say, to get an A in a college class. Right intention is the adherence to a triplet of key Buddhist values that we maintain in our actions, namely renunciation, kindness, and harmlessness. Right understanding provides the map, and right intention provides the compass to ensure we stay on course in our practice. We've all gotten lost, either without a map or unable to locate ourselves on a map. But know that if we keep heading west, say, we will get closer to our destination. Confused about our exact dharmic location, if we remember to turn in the direction of renunciation, kindness, and harmlessness, we know we can still make progress. Right speech is the practice so that our verbal actions become beneficial, harmless, and conducive to the purity of mind that we seek to develop on the path. We often don't realize that wrong speech is powerful. That is why we say actions speak louder than words. But speech can cause enormous harm. The Buddha highlights right speech because a misspoken word or two can be poison. Right action is to practice so that our bodily actions become beneficial, harmless, and conducive to the purity of mind that we seek to develop on the path. In this case, action refers specifically to bodily karma, like giving a monk alms or like chopping firewood for your grandparents, in contrast to verbal or mental action. Right livelihood is to choose one's career path carefully so that we do not obligate ourselves to conditions that require wrong speech or wrong action or that undermine the various other aspects of practice. The choice of livelihood is not an everyday task, but once made, it's a major determinant of our success on the path. Right effort is to be vigilant in making proper choices to choose what is wholesome and to reject what is unwholesome. Right effort is a part of right everything else. It is the well-directed energy of our practice and is supposed to overcome obstacles to practice. We began the discussion last week with recollection and effort. We now see that these are reflected in two of the eight steps on the Noble Eightfold Path. They are themselves skills that must be carefully trained and cultivated. Right recollection, or right mindfulness, is bringing to mind and bearing in mind the Dharma. It most commonly attends to the practice situation and brings to mind the full body of teachings relevant to that situation. Right recollection makes sure there is no conflict with any of the other steps in the path. Finally, the proper integrated functioning of the first seven steps on the Noble Eightfold Path result periodically in the arising of the final step, which is right mental composure, also known as concentration or absorption. It's a rarefied meditative state that is serene, clear, and undistracted, while collecting and balancing an array of skillful mental factors, among which are those developed in all of the previous seven path factors. Mental composure has various functions, but ultimately it is an instrument for insight, that is, for a fine-tuned, intuitive understanding of the world based on Dharma. Right mental composure takes full possession of the previous path factors, perfecting them and making them second nature. The word right here in each of these eight steps on the path is normative. It's roughly synonymous with skillful. We saw last week that we keep our actions skillful through understanding what is skillful and what is unskillful, and then being attentively mindful of that understanding. Then we exert effort to move away from the unskillful and toward the skillful. Similarly, the Buddha tells us, right understanding is the forerunner. And how is right understanding the forerunner? One discerns wrong action as wrong action and right action as right action. One tries to abandon wrong action and enter into right action. This is one's right effort. One remembers to abandon wrong action and to remain in right action. This is one's right recollection. Thus, these three qualities, right understanding, right effort, and right recollection, run and circle around right action. This passage circles around right action, but it's said verbatim for each of right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. By golly, this is simply the process we've been looking at, whereby right recollection monitors the present situation like a thermostat bearing the relevant standard in mind, and then right effort kicks in to produce a skillful result. Right mindfulness is also specifically defined in some places as a refined practice of mindful observation. This is very important. Mindful observation is literally attending by recollection, but is often translated as foundations of mindfulness or as establishment of mindfulness. Its core instruction is stated by the Buddha as follows. And what monks, is right recollection? Here, monks, a monk dwells observing the body, in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, recollective, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. He dwells observing feelings in feelings. He dwells observing mind in mind. He dwells observing phenomena in phenomena. Ardent, clearly comprehending, recollective, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. This is right mindfulness. It's important to point out that here in one of the best-known passages of the entire early Buddhist texts, right mindfulness is defined as a task of observation that involves recollection. But recollection is only one of a cluster of factors mentioned. Observation adds a new layer to recollection, asking us to back up one step from our world of experience or activity with full awareness. This is a powerful practice and the seat of introspection in Buddhism. For instance, rather than just breathe, we observe that we are breathing. Rather than just walk, we observe that we are walking. Rather than just think, we observe that we are thinking. In principle, if we can perform a task, we can keep in mind to observe the performance of that task. There is an open-ended list of topics of observation divided into categories. First, body. Second, feeling. 3, mind. And 4, phenomena. We'll see later that mindful observation plays a particularly important role in the development of both virtue and wisdom. Adding observation to mindfulness, but calling it right recollection, is what linguists call metonymy. We do something similar when we call a king the crown, or a particular event 9/11. We name a certain type of observation, right mindfulness, after an identifying factor. In English, when we are mindful of washing the dishes, we are recollectively observing the washing of the dishes. Both washing and observing are done mindfully. Some authors prefer awareness for mindful observation. Cultivating general mindfulness. Recollection in itself is a skill to be learned and cultivated. It shows up in Buddhism in relationship to keeping the Dharma in mind, but an analogous version of recollection practice exists in virtually every skill, such as cooking or archery, shuffleboard or beekeeping, ceramics or deactivating bombs. I imagine that certain kinds of provocative women's clothing require a lot of mindfulness. The wearer must attend to the kinesthetic state of the clothing and also keep in mind norms of social propriety and even law. Wearing monk's robes also requires recollection, and it takes months to master the skill. But the point is different. The Buddha often described monks of good practice on alms round passing from house to house in utmost mindfulness. How do we optimize mindfulness? Discussion so far suggests that we can stay mindful if we, one, stay on a well-defined task, two, avoid distractions from that task, three, bring ardency to that task, and four, observe that task. As to the first, we should avoid multitasking, such as listening to music or practicing our two-step while cutting carrots, or such as driving, drinking coffee, smoking, talking on the cell phone, listening to music, and wishing we were already home all at the same time. With multitasking, it's hard to pinpoint just what task we're supposed to be keeping in mind in any case. In the Zen tradition, it's said, when chopping wood, just chop wood. When carrying water, just carry water. The second part of staying mindfulness is avoiding distractions from that task. When chopping carrots, we should put aside from our thought stream anything that is not helping to chop carrots. This includes striving or hurrying. However, we remain mindful of our knowledge of knife, cutting board, and root vegetable. In this way, we settle into the how of the activity. The third thing we can do to stay mindful is to bring ardency to the task. We're ardent when we're competent in our task. If the task is not challenging enough, we can impose particularly high standards on our task by introducing constraints, such as cutting carrots in uniform slices, or by dividing routine tasks into well-defined subtasks and doing them in a fixed order. Zen has been very creative in ritualizing everyday tasks as a way to develop mindfulness. The fourth way we can stay mindful is to observe the task. Pick a particular object of examination and observe it, remembering to keep the single task in mind and to let go of distractions. This is the basis of many common meditation techniques, such as sitting on the cushion and following the breath. Alternatively, you can mindfully watch whatever comes up in experience, whether sounds, thoughts, emotions, and so on. Ardency comes with a sense of curiosity, but be careful not to get caught up in detailed thinking about the object you are watching. Let the world do the talking and attend to every word. Practice while sitting on a cushion often begins with general mindfulness. For instance, when we remember to observe the breath for sustained periods. Many everyday situations provide similar opportunities for training the mind to stay on task. You can also become an observer as you're engaged in a primary task like chopping carrots. It will feel like you are perched on your own shoulder watching someone else chopping carrots. It's easy to appreciate how these four aspects of the skill in mindfulness produce stability of mind. The mind settles onto a single theme, does not thrash from one thing to another, acquires a certain delight in the present, and steps back from our direct engagement in affairs. We will see that mindfulness, with little encouragement, tends to result in delight, in serenity, and finally in mental composure. What is being present? Modern literature often describes mindfulness as being in the present moment, even though mindfulness recollects the past. Let's look at this. The present is suspended between past and future, and any task we perform there is potentially conditioned by either past or future concerns, or by both. Avoiding distractions in mindfulness cause a shift in what happens in the present moment. The past concerns communicated through mindfulness are typically learned values, standards, and techniques. They define the how of the present task. The future concerns, on the other hand, generally take the form of self-concern striving in response to fears and desires. They define the why of the task. Ideally, mindfulness attends to the needs of the task at hand, while striving attends to the neediness of me. While mindfulness upholds, striving contrives. Now, striving counts as an unskillful distraction as we try to be mindful. Therefore, the why drops out of mind while the how remains. This nudges the motivational structure of the task. We inhabit the task as something satisfying in pursuing well, rather than utilizing the task for some purpose outside of the task itself. This is why the current topic is called Living in Mindfulness. As we live in mindfulness, me tends to get lost in the task at hand. For instance, if our action is washing dishes, mindfulness brings to mind an array of knowledge and experience about which implement to scrub with, about how much detergent to use, about how much force to exert, about how hot the water should be, and so on. Without mindfulness, our future concerns might induce us to hurry through the job so we can have some real fun or look forward to the praise we'll receive for having washed the dishes. Thich Nhat Hanh tells us that it's best if we wash the dishes in order to wash the dishes rather than in order to have clean dishes. This makes washing the dishes more an act of devotion rather than a utilitarian act. In washing in order to wash, mindfulness rather than striving becomes the guide. Similarly, a sales employee named Bob in a clothing store can be mindful of the inventory, color schemes, current fashions, and so on. At the same time, he is intent on getting a commission for a successful sale and worried about doing something that will get him fired. When Bob is worried about being fired or anxious for a bonus, he's been known to cut corners and lie a little to the customer, sometimes to overcharge, all out of striving. But with mindfulness training, Bob is likely to be diligent, upright, and honest in his approach to his job. He might still get fired, but it's actually more likely for his boss, admiring his greater competence and the acclaim of customers, to give him a raise. The two strands of practice. There are two intertwined strands of development in the Noble Eightfold Path. One is virtue, and the other is wisdom. Virtue is also known as ethics or morality, and is clearly the subject of the path factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Also, right intention sets the limits of skillful action across the board within the ethical parameters of renunciation, kindness, and harmlessness. And then right understanding, right effort, and right mindfulness are helpers in practicing all of these virtue-related path factors. The strand of wisdom begins in right understanding of how we otherwise misinterpret our circumstances, the world and our minds, ourselves, and then behave on the basis of those misinterpretations. Delusion underlies our impulse toward what is unskillful, and virtue helps rid us of the perceptual distortion associated with self-centeredness. Therefore, virtue and wisdom develop together, virtue largely through reconditioning our behaviors according to Dharma, and wisdom through investigation of our minds in the light of Dharma. Investigation, aided by mental composure, internalizes right understanding to refine wisdom and make it second nature and to help us see through the eyes of the Buddha. Right mental composure folds in the previous seven path factors and therefore represents the consummation of ethics and wisdom. Mental composure is also based in delight and serenity, a natural result of the virtuous and wise tasks performed with right mindfulness. Serenity might be seen to represent a third strand running through the Noble Eightfold Path that also culminates in mental composure. We'll see in what follows that mental composure arises quite readily as we engage in skillful practices of all sorts in which we're able to optimize mindfulness.
Further resources related to this course, Mindfulness, Where Dharma Meets Practice, are available at Sitagu, that is Sitagu, sitagu.org/shortlinks/mindful.